At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Hello, listeners. If you're hearing this, I'm going to assume you're at least interested in money and understanding the economy and finances. And some of us want our kids to have that knowledge, too. Check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. You can learn more at greenlight.com/million. And tune in to Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts.
This is a totally serious question. What is it going to take, do you suppose, to get the workforce back into this recovery? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday, the 1st of June. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Just a heads up, this is going to be a jobs-centric kind of week for economic news. The May unemployment report comes out Friday morning. Guess at your own risk, I should say here, given the big miss last time. 1 million new jobs was the rumor. 266,000 was the actual. So there will be no prognostication here. What there will be is this observation. We have more jobs available in this economy right now than we have workers who want them. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce is out with a report today that says there is an all-time high of 8.1 million job openings and not enough available workers who are able or willing to take those jobs as offered. This was happening before the pandemic, the chamber says, but as with so many other things, the past year and the pandemic has accelerated the trend. So, what happened to the American workforce? Marketplace's Kimberly Adams starts us off.
The U.S. Chamber of Commerce came up with what it calls a worker availability ratio. How many workers are available for every open position? Right now, that's 1.4 workers per job. Normally, it's more like 2.8. Some of that is due to skills gaps and immigration policy, but says the chamber's Neil Bradley,
the pandemic and some of the pandemic responses have created new barriers for people to return to the workforce.
Like remote learning or childcare centers closing, a lack of before and after school care. And, says Bradley, those companies are struggling to hire as well.
The industries that need workers are also the industries that we need to recover to be able to help other people get back to work.
Many economists point to the quality of jobs and pay as additional reasons why workers may not be rushing to go back for the salaries offered. Lily Roberts is with the Center for American Progress.
If there are enough workers for the jobs, I think the thing that we have a shortage of is jobs that are good enough to take right now.
Many industries are raising wages and offering bonuses, but we are relatively early in the reopening. Joyce Jacobson is president at Hobart and William Smith Colleges and an economics professor.
It seems like it's been a fairly short time for us to be crying shortage, as opposed to that we're still in the adjustment back to full opening.
Vaccines were only recently widely available, plus there are still millions of unemployed people. Jacobson says there is one area with a true labor shortage at the moment: summer jobs, once filled by teenagers, more recently foreign workers who can't get visas due to the pandemic. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Teenagers often can, as Kimberly alluded to right at the end there, take jobs that might not be attractive to people with mortgages and families. In point of fact, last month's jobs report did show teenage employment at levels that haven't been seen since before the financial crisis. And as Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino reports now from the Workplace Culture Desk, signs might be pointing to an even bigger teen job boom this summer.
For generations, a summer job has been a teenage rite of passage.
I spent my summers, I worked at a pizza shop, and I think it's a great way to both earn some savings and to gain skills that you're not able to gain in the classroom.
Luke Pardue is now an economist at payroll platform Gusto, which works with businesses eager to attract teen workers. He says pay in retail and tourism have jumped, and companies have added perks like free food and amusement park passes for new employees.
Teenagers are really, they have all of the chips.
So far, white adolescents have seen the biggest gains in employment this year. Young workers were among the hardest hit by lockdowns. But teenage employment has been dropping for decades, says one-time camp counselor Alicia Sasser-Modestino, now an economist at Northeastern University.
With each successive recession, we've seen the labor force participation rate for teens drop and then just not recover.
The benefits of low-wage work have diminished, and teens have shifted to more school-related activities like summer classes, sports, and internships. But rising wages could lure more teens back to traditional summer jobs, says Andrew Challenger of staffing firm Challenger Gray & Christmas, and former barista.
Kids want to get out of the house. They've been cooped up for a long time, and there aren't as many school-based activities for them to do this year.
His firm projects teens will add about 2 million jobs to the economy this summer. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
Lifeguarding lawn mowing for me. On Wall Street today, traders got back into things nice and easy-like. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. President Biden was in Tulsa today, marking the 100th anniversary of the Tulsa race massacre. And in his speech, laying down a marker of sorts on the systemic racism in this economy, the president announced a couple of things he wants to do to try to narrow the racial wealth gap, a gap that has the average black family in the United States having just a tenth of the net worth of the average white family. On the president's list, proposals to reduce racial discrimination in housing and increasing black home ownership. And as Marketplace's Samantha Fields reports, one key way the Biden administration plans to do that is by addressing the real racial disparities in home appraisals.
Home ownership is one of the key ways for people to build wealth in the U.S. But white Americans are much more likely to own homes than black or Latinx Americans. And their homes are also worth more, says Junia Howell, a sociologist who studies housing appraisals.
Homes in white neighborhoods are worth, on average, almost $250,000 more than comparable homes in similar Black and Latinx communities.
One major reason for that, Howell says, is that homes in predominantly white neighborhoods are often appraised to be worth more than comparable homes in predominantly Black or Latinx neighborhoods. And
the racial inequality in appraisals is growing over time.
The gap nearly doubled between 1980 and 2015. Because one of the main factors appraisers consider in determining how much a house is worth is how much other comparable homes nearby have sold for recently. And after years of redlining, segregation, and other forms of housing discrimination, Andre Perry at the Brookings Institution says,
when you compare homes to others in neighborhoods that have been discriminated against, you essentially recycle discrimination over and over again.
It's a vicious cycle. Elora Lee Raymond at Georgia Tech says,
that can really determine how much wealth you accumulate by owning your home. And so that is going to contribute hugely to the wealth gap in this country because home equity is 50% of household wealth.
Raymond says the Biden administration's plan to address racial discrimination in home appraisals is an important step.
But it doesn't necessarily make it possible for Black households to become homeowners. It doesn't really do much about that.
One thing that would, Raymond says, would be some kind of down payment assistance. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
Lumber prices fell today, continuing a month-long slide from their recent highs. Still, though, real expensive, up give or take 400% from a year ago. That is mostly new wood, to be clear, from newly felled trees. Marketplace's Amy Scott has a different kind of lumber story now about this pandemic and those prices and the growing payoff from what had been a kind of a niche industry, reclaimed wood.
It smells good inside the warehouse of brick and board in Baltimore, like freshly cut wood. Only the wood itself, stacked floor to ceiling on one side of the shop, isn't so fresh.
We're taking old wood, materials that we've salvaged from buildings that are 100, 200, sometimes close to 300 years old, and processing it so that it can be used for another 100 years or so.
Max Pollock owns Brick and Board. The 6-year-old company sells reclaimed bricks and boards to builders and woodworkers. A lot of the wood comes from right here in Baltimore, where hundreds of vacant and abandoned houses are torn down every year.
So we still have to take the nails out of it, clean all the dust and, you know, the century of grime and crap that accrues on it.
Once that's done,
we have our circuit of machinery. We run it through and, you know, turn it into flooring or wall paneling or tabletops or what have you.
Every month, some of that wood is sold to the high-end furniture retailer Room & Board through a partnership with the U.S. Forest Service. It's turned into pieces like the McKean console table, named for a street of demoed row houses in West Baltimore. Price tag, $1,400. Pollock also salvages wood from old barns and industrial buildings. Upstairs, he shows me a stack of floorboards from a pottery factory coated in clay dust. The factory was probably 100 years old, but the boards are old-growth redwood.
You're touching stuff that was alive 2,000 years ago, and that's really the special part of our work and the special part of the wood that we deal with.
You can't really log wood like this anymore, and recovering it takes a lot of labor and energy, which is why it's typically more expensive than new lumber. But as those prices have soared,
we're seeing people who never would have considered this because of the price. Now you're paying a little bit more for something that's a lot more beautiful.
That sold carpenter Josh Dean on some white oak from Brick and Board. He's building an outdoor bar for Le Comptoir du Vin, a local restaurant and wine shop, and was planning to use lumber from Home Depot. Then he priced it out.
The white oak was about $450, I think, and the 2x4 lumber was just barely under that. It's kind of crazy.
The bar is a side gig. Dean's main job is building pipe organs.
I was very happy as a woodworker to not have to use 2x4s because it's way better looking, just a better looking wood.
Business is also up a few miles away at Second Chance, which sells reclaimed lumber and architectural salvage out of a massive warehouse. Many of the workers were once incarcerated and are getting a second chance themselves. CEO Mark Foster says though the warehouse reduced its hours during the pandemic,
we're up by about 35% year over year, and we're doing that kind of volume in 4 days instead of 7.
Second Chance is a nonprofit and can sell for lower prices than big retailers.
We tend to be about 30% to 40% below Home Depot, and we adjust accordingly. And over the last year, we've had to adjust a lot, and that's mostly been up. That's all been up, as a matter of fact.
Reclaimed wood isn't typically graded for structural building, say framing a house, so it's not going to help solve the housing shortage. But more builders are using it for things like decks and flooring. The question is whether they'll keep coming if the price of new lumber comes down. Brick and Board's Max Pollock has been thinking about that.
The hope is that people might still be drawn to this because of beauty, because of history, because of the story attached to it.
A return to normal prices in the new market might even help the market for old wood. Another longtime seller told me if builders don't have to spend so much on the wood you don't see, the framing, they'll have more to spend on the decorative details you do see. In Baltimore, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Coming up,
It's been nice being able to like basically start over in a way.
Yeah, that would be nice, wouldn't it? First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 45 points today, about a 10%, 34,575. The NASDAQ down 10, just under a 10%. Basically flat, I should have said, 13,736. S&P 500, well, that was flat, 42.2. As we heard in Megan's piece about teen summer jobs, unemployment among 16 to 19-year-olds is at its lowest point in years, just 12.3%. Given the shortage of adult workers right now, as reported by one Kimberly Adams, there are more openings for teens in industries like food service and retail. Thus, Chipotle down almost 0.8% today. The Gap folding almost 1%. Albertsons up 2.4% today. Bond prices rose. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note fell to 1.60%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business, evolving your passions. We push what technology can do, so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Gusto. Look, payday is awesome, but running payroll, calculating taxes and deductions, staying compliant, that's not easy. Unless, of course, you have Gusto. Gusto is a simple online payroll and benefits tool built for small businesses like yours. Gusto gets your team paid while automatically filing your payroll taxes. Plus, you can offer benefits like 401k, health insurance, and workers' comp. Just for listening today, you also get 3 months free. Go to gusto.com/marketplace. That's gusto.com/marketplace.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Consumer patterns change. Companies adapt. That is kind of the way it goes. And in no way have consumer habits changed more the past year than in this. Instead of going to an actual store to get what you want, millions of us are pointing and clicking, and presto, whatever we want shows up on our doorstep. But to get that, whatever it is that we want, from the warehouse into your hands, takes a whole lot of people along the way, including truck drivers, an industry that's having, as a lot of industries are, staffing problems. So we got Daryl Harris on the phone the other day. He's the president of Yellow Corporation. That's a trucking company based in Overland Park, Kansas. And I asked him about his biggest challenges.
Our biggest issue right now is we have a driver shortage. And according to the American Trucking Association, our industry right now needs an additional 60,000 truck drivers ASAP. And it's a deficit that's expected to grow by more than 160,000 by 2028.
Why do you need so many drivers? Yes, lots of stuff moves on trucks. And yes, there's pent-up demand. We've been talking about that for months now. Why is it so severe right now for your industry?
Well, what a lot of people may not realize is that 70% of the nation's freight is carried by commercial trucks, and they're carrying everything from dishwashers to construction supplies and, of course, all that stuff we like to buy on Amazon. And COVID has shown Americans really the importance of the trucking profession. You know, our drivers and dock workers worked around the clock through the pandemic to get essential goods to homes and businesses across the country during COVID, and we continue that pace today.
I read somewhere that turnover among truck drivers in this economy is like 90%. First of all, is that right? And second of all, what do you do about that?
Well, the thing you have to realize in trucking is, you know, all drivers are not created equal, so to speak. You know, we are actually in the less than truckload side of the trucking business. And what that means is our drivers range from city drivers to medium range drivers. And then, of course, we do have what they call long haul. Yeah. But it really comes down to the lifestyle that comes along with this space. And in our space, we don't experience that type of turnover.
Right, right. So less than truckload drivers can get home at night. If you're long hauling it, though, you're not going to be able to do that, which certainly makes sense. But if I wanted to get into trucking today, let's say I'm an ambitious, you know, 25-year-old, I want to be out on the road. How much am I going to make driving a truck?
Industry average right now is about $55,000 a year. But honestly, we have about 500 folks that made over $100,000 last year.
Which seems nifty.
It's absolutely nifty, and we're doing everything we can to really educate folks on, you know, the opportunities that exist within trucking.
Well, tell me a little bit about that, right? Because as you said, there's huge demand. We've got some turnover in the long haul space, and while making $100,000 is nice, it comes with a price being away from home. So how else are you retaining drivers?
And I'll be honest, you know, drivers in the industry are aging. You know, many have been with our company for 20, 30, even 40 years, Kai. So, you know, some retirement age drivers retired during COVID, which is also affecting the shortage. And we're determining options to keep them on the job, at least part-time, if they're interested.
So what happens if, and you know, there are something like 3.5 million truck drivers in this economy. I imagine both less than truckload and long haul. So industry-wide, about 3.5 million. What happens if, over time, we wind up not having enough people to drive trucks?
Well, we're not going to let that happen. But, you know, in the end of the day, we're doing everything we can to keep drivers in trucks and to start bringing new people into the business.
I appreciate that you say you're not going to let that happen, but there are some things that are out of your control, even though you are the president of this company. And I do want to know what happens to consumers if somehow we don't have enough truckers out there.
Right. Well, I think what you're going to see is increases in the cost of goods if that were to occur. And so this is a serious issue. It's serious for our country, certainly serious for our industry, and it's one that we're focused on now more than ever.
Darrell Harris, he's the president of Yellow Corporation. They do, as you heard, less than truckload trucking. Mr. Harris, thanks for your time, sir. I appreciate that.
Thank you, Kai. I appreciate it.
You need your early morning business and economic news. We get that. That's why we have David Brancaccio getting out of bed early to deliver it to you on the Marketplace Morning Report. Check it out. With the caveat that all businesses had to adapt during the pandemic, they all had to make some sometimes difficult decisions. Restaurants arguably had the worst of it. Restaurant owners have had to cut staff or cut their hours, or in a lot of cases, just shut down. And even the ones that have been able to stay open have had to change the way they have been doing things. A lot of those changes, though, made their businesses more efficient. And now that the economy's been coming back, a lot of those tough decisions are starting to pay off, as Marketplace's Justin Ho reports.
Here's one way things have changed at Nico Freccia's 21st Amendment Brewery in the Bay Area. As soon as customers are seated,
they don't have to wait to be approached by a server. They don't have to wait for somebody to come over and give them specials.
They scan a QR code with their phones and order beers and food immediately. Now, Freccia says he's planning on running his big outdoor events the same way.
You need less staff. People feel safer because they're not passing around money and touching things that other people are touching. They don't have to wait in line instead of being able to drink beer.
At the Baltimore sandwich restaurant, Ekiben, co-owner Steve Chu made a small decision to cut the phone line. It saves him some money, but it also means his staff doesn't have to spend time answering questions like, what time is the restaurant open? And does your bread have gluten in it?
It was like stuff that you could just go on Google and like look. And that was taking up a lot of time and like really stressing out the team.
At the Falls Church, Virginia restaurant, Thompson Italian, co-owner Gabe Thompson has been working to streamline the menu and cutting down the number of steps required to prepare items like the marinara sauce. Thompson says making the production process leaner has helped the restaurant be more nimble.
The pandemic really helped us get to a point where we're like, dude, that thing is no longer on the menu. So we can bring it back if we want to, but we don't have to. And we can use the noodle for something else. And so it's been nice being able to like basically start over in a way.
Small changes like these add up, and they've been happening throughout the restaurant industry.
Like examples of this might be, say, a restaurant that now operates with one general manager instead of a three-manager front of house.
Matt Hetrick runs the accounting firm Harmony Group, which focuses on small business clients. He says the pandemic forced restaurants to become more efficient. It also provided opportunities for them to receive government aid.
What they're coming out of pandemic with is stronger balance sheets and realistically more effective organizations.
That's helped businesses like Thompson Italian turn a profit during the pandemic. Co-owner Catherine Thompson says the restaurant's been putting that money into building a new deck and working on a new patio space.
You know, I think if we didn't have that cash cushion, we would be much more hesitant to spend the money to then bring in more business.
And this year, Thompson says they're thinking about expanding.
We're definitely looking for spaces. We haven't nailed anything yet.
A lot of businesses have gotten leaner by shedding staff. When the pandemic started, Jennifer Vitagliano's Michelin-starred Manhattan restaurant, The Musket Room, went from being a full-fledged fine dining experience with 38 employees to a two-person operation. Vitagliano and her chef.
She was downstairs cooking and I was upstairs, you know, making sure no one robbed the place and interacting with customers.
Since then, Vitagliano says she slowly brought back most of her staff. Some of the experiments she tried during the pandemic, like selling pastries out of a vintage food truck, didn't really make sense for the long haul. But others did. The kitchens sharing more ingredients with the bar, even using excess food like coffee beans and citrus peels to make house liqueurs.
So little things like that were kind of born out of necessity that are just part of our day-to-day now.
Vitagliano says if the restaurant keeps running as efficiently as it has in the last few months, its revenue next year will be higher than in 2019, before the pandemic. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, in which you can hold two contradictory facts in your mind at the same time. The Financial Times got its hands on some internal Nestle documents the other day, in which the maker of, among other things, Kit Kat bars and Stouffer's, admits, and this is the quote, "Some of our categories and products will never be healthy no matter how much we renovate." So, yes. But Nestle CEO Mark Schneider told Bloomberg last fall, this is also a quote, "Confectionery and chocolate address a deep human need and are going to be here to stay." I mean, also, yes, right? All right, we got to go, but here's your moment of economic context weekend box office edition. I know 9 people who went to see a movie this weekend, like in a cinema, which help explain this. Total ticket sales for the 4 days, more than $100 million. Yes, way less than the before times, but still, progress. Now, turns out they went to see A Quiet Place 2, which, scary? Me? No. Andy Corbin, Richard Cunningham, Rhea Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, Daisy Palacios, and Minju Park are the daily production team around here. I don't know what movies they go to. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.